This is Dr. David Charish, dive medicine physician. On this episode of Fitness and Diving, we will have a conversation with third-generation ocean explorer, ocean conservationist, and aquanaut, Fabien Cousteau. Fabien was an explorer at large for National Geographic. In June 2014, Fabien and his team of aquanauts embarked on Mission 31, the longest science expedition to take place at Aquarius Reef Base, the world's only underwater marine laboratory located in Florida. Early in 2016, he founded the Fabien Cousteau Ocean Learning Center to fulfill his dream of creating a vehicle to make a positive change in the world. His current project, Proteus, an international space station of the ocean, and a 3D mapping initiative off the coast of Curaçao will be featured in a conversation. Understanding one's fitness in diving can allow for safe diving practices when diving in such harsh environments. Please join us for this important conversation. Fabien, thank you for taking the time to join us in the conversation on fitness and diving.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So we would all like to hear first about your most recent project, the Proteus Ocean Group.
Well, Proteus Ocean Group is essentially a management company that is poised to manage, to execute, and to make sure that the project Proteus, or more specifically the habitat Proteus, becomes a reality, becomes a model that can shepherd both education and research, as well as be a platform for those out there who may be able to stand or to use a International Space Station of the ocean as their research platform. Essentially, a company that is comprised of people who are experts in the business and financial world, as well as in the scientific world, so that we can offer a very unique way to have a better finger on the pulse of the ocean's health.
How did this whole group or project evolve?
Well, Project Proteus and the Proteus Ocean Group subsequently were created essentially because of the experience with Mission 31, where I spent 31 days with my team in the world's last undersea habitat. And it is, on one side, a bit of a dinosaur, because as we speak today, it's about 36 years old. And on another hand, it's very unique as a platform, because it's the only one of its kind, a underwater research lab, more specifically, maybe more an education lab than anything else. And it gives us the opportunity to be saturated, and gives a, even though it's the size of a school bus, it still gives us access to the undersea world as non-commercial divers. And so with that vehicle, it opened up my eyes a few years back that things that were created back in my grandfather's day, underwater habitats, to see if we could live and work underwater, are a very valuable tool that we're missing in today's world of ocean exploration.
And what are the goals of the Proteus project?
A couple of the goals it really stem back to my previous experiences in aquanaut, which are two things. One, as a scientific and research platform to collect data, both on the human being who is using it as an aquanaut, but also the ocean. We know so very little about our ocean world, and we can stand to gain a lot of knowledge. It's quite literally Pandora's box waiting to be opened. And on the second aspect or goal, if you will, is being an outreach platform, one that will be able to connect the vast majority of the world who may never get a chance to go diving, much less become an aquanaut, become familiar with the ocean in a way that's a bit more intimate and a bit more emotional, so that those people out there, the vast majority of the world, will be connected in a way that they care. The ocean's health is quite literally directly related to our very own. And until we stop ignoring the ocean, until we stop using it as an endless resource in a garbage can, and we start shepherding it and its health the way we would like to shepherd our very own health, we are missing the boat, and we are creating a dynamic that we're unfortunately seeing the repercussions of today.
Absolutely. It's really, really an interesting story so far. So this is a collaborative venture from a vast group of different people coming together as an organization. Is that correct?
In a sense, yeah, it's a social good enterprise. So although it is a for-profit and it's investable and all those things, the point of it is that there's a give back element to the world. And as part of that, I see it more as a type of United Nations platform, in the sense that it's inviting various entities, not a platform just for ourselves and our own use, but one that can be used by the biochemistry world, that can be used by, of course, marine biologists and researchers out there, that can be used as an anecdote for space colonization, that can be used as a giant hyperbaric chamber, if you will,
right,
with the ability to bring in and cater to the maximum amount of equipment and personnel to do those sorts of experiments. So it gives a lot of flexibility. And because of its modularity, it will be continually adaptable and upgradable and future resistant.
So what's the current state of the project so far?
Well, we actually announced it during COVID, which not the best timing in the world, but despite that, we've had a lot of traction. We went through the pre-seed stage very successfully. We're now in the seed stage of investment. And provided that trajectory keeps on going, we'll be into the final round of funding. And in the meantime, we've just signed up an EPC, which is an engineering procurement firm that is very, very has a very good reputation in the world of underwater structures, a company called DROS. They are involved in military and commercial vessels meaning structures, and saturation structures, as well as other things. We have an MOU with the government of Curaçao, which was signed within 2 weeks with the entirety of the government ministers, including the prime minister. Which is unheard of in the world of politics and especially island nations. So we were very encouraged by that enthusiasm. We have some local business people who are also extremely interested in having us and shepherding us to success, as well as the nonprofit Karmabi, a local entity that oversees and manages the marine protected area, which we have been granted access to. And so the list goes on and on of check marks and successes. So we're really excited about that. But there's still a lot of work to be done. We still have to get to the point of bending metal. So right now we're going through the architecture and the engineering schematics to make sure that this underwater structure that is modular in nature, which is a first of its kind, which is going to be future upgradable, which of course requires a lot of thought in an extreme right. environment. There's still a lot to be done, a lot of work to be done, but at the end of the day, anything is possible. And, we have the technical skills and understanding and engineering prowess at this point, meaning the greater world, to execute on those things. The next goal is by the end of this year, we'll be bending metal, so to speak. And we're going to start construction. And provided that construction phase is on time and we don't have any more pandemic issues, we should be able to install Proteus by the end of 2025, Q4 of 2025.
Wow. Impressive.
With first mission 2026.
So I read in the news that you were doing some ocean mapping in Curaçao. Was that part of the Proteus project?
Yeah. So, there's a lot of prep work in order to be able to build and install something of this size. It's 10 times the size of Aquarius. And in order to be able to do environmental mitigation, make sure that we minimize our impact. We'll have an impact, obviously, but minimize our impact and maximize the benefits, you have to do a bunch of assessments. One of them is, what does the bottom look like? You know, we have an average slope of 45 degrees in Curaçao. It's on a seamount, so the depths go pretty quickly. That plays a lot into the engineering aspects, of course, with the stanchions and all that. But it also plays a lot into the execution of missions. How do you make sure people stay safe? Because many of these, supposedly many of these tenants that is part of the economic model and research model, how many of these tenants are qualified to be able to go diving at such depths? So we're debating whether we keep it at nitrox kind of air breathing mix, or do we play with trimixes?
Right.
Technologically, that's either one is perfectly executable, but we have to think of our guests, our tenants,
sure,
who are going to be using it.
Safety would be.
Yeah. And in the benthic measurements, all we had to do was we brought the personnel and equipment. All we had to do really is the kilometer around Proteus, or around the site of Proteus. But we ended up mapping the entire MPA, which we subsequently gave to the government of Curaçao as a gesture of goodwill and as part of our mission.
Sure.
You know, it's all about sharing the information we have as much as we can.
Wow, that's fantastic. So if you had to summarize then long-term goals for Proteus, three or four bits of information that we could take home, what would that be?
Well, Proteus will be a data gathering station, as well as a beacon of hope, so that we can generate executable solutions to the things that we're faced with today, be it cures for pandemics, be it robotics, be it the ability to address issues. Physiological, psychological issues in extreme environments on site, so telemedicine, that sort of thing, and the ability to cater to a whole new world, the 99% of our world's living space, which is the ocean. You know, because we've explored so little of it, we don't know what we don't know. What we do know is that we're losing opportunities left and right as we wait. And there are a lot of great tools in the toolbox of ocean exploration, but none of them give you that tactile nature of being there in person. And having that human technological interface on the final frontier of our planet is essential for us to not only enrich our own understanding, but the understanding for the general public.
Sure. And, you know, I've known you for a few years now. And what we didn't mention earlier was that you are the grandson of Jacques Cousteau, son of Jean-Michel Cousteau, brother of Céline Cousteau, a prominent filmmaker and environmentalist in her own right. So you have this great ocean exploration lineage, and you exude this lust and interest in ocean exploration and protecting the ocean environment. It really comes out every time I've heard you, met you, talked to you. So thank you for that. So here's a question. How old were you when you first put on a scuba tank?
Well, to your point, I've been addicted to ocean from a very young age.
Right.
And that's really because I was immersed in the ocean environment from the ripe old age of 4 years old. And my first scuba dive was on my fourth birthday. Subsequently, a couple of weeks later, I went diving in the Channel Islands, more specifically Catalina Island. And the feelings, the emotional feelings one gets to be immersed in an alien environment for the very first time. I still remember it today, even though I was such a young kid. I mean, this was decades ago. But sitting there at the bottom, you forget that it's temperate water. So it's cold water, 50 degrees. And you're looking around, and everywhere you look, looks like a cathedral with these kelp forests and these shafts of light going through, and the spotted, the colors of the Garibaldi, the orange that spots everywhere. It looks almost like stained glass. And that, for a split second, just burns itself into your memory. And the movement and the interaction, it's like a soap opera unfolding in front of your eyes. It's mesmerizing. And I've never lost that sense of curiosity and wonder and just looking at a square meter of ocean floor and just seeing new things every single time. It's an amazing place. It's one that is very unfamiliar to us terrestrial creatures until you peek below that blue veneer and your eyes are opened up for the very first time.
Right. And it takes me back to your grandfather's book, who first opened our eyes as non-divers to understand what the undersea world is all about. So as the grandson of Jacques Cousteau, you have spent your early years aboard your grandfather's ships, the Calypso and the Alcyon, further developing your passion for diving, ocean exploration, and conservation. How was that?
Not as easy as people would think. Working for family, I guess it depends on your family, but mine was very much a proponent of you work from the bottom up like everybody else. And I remember, because I had learned to scuba dive from a young age, and by the way, for those listeners out there, and I'm sure Dr. Trash would be able to tell you better than I, it's not something you should do with your kids. Wait till they're of age. But at the end of the day, I spent my summers scrubbing the barnacles off the hull of Calypso, painting the rails, chipping the rust off the engine parts, all those things. And those were my summer jobs. The reason for that is not so much to, you know, put your kids into, you know, labor and all that, but it's to understand what a community on a ship is like, why these posts, why these different jobs are so important, and how people help each other when you're in a middle of nowhere, the Amazon, Red Sea, the Arctic, whatever. You have to be dependent on each other, and everyone performs a vital role, regardless of what their role is. And working with each other and taking up slack where needs be and all that is the quintessential feeling of community. And that was really important growing up. And I've always said that I will never ask someone to do something I'm not willing to do myself because of that education growing up. And so it gives a real sense of appreciation for those very valuable things. Eventually I got to be part of the dive crew and everything else, which was the in front of the camera sexy part, but
sure.
All the other jobs were just as important, if not even more so.
Absolutely. So you've been involved as an explorer at large with the National Geographic. You were involved in a multi-hour series for PBS with your father and sister, Jean-Michel and Céline. So how was that experience working with your father and your sister?
I love working with my family. They're a total pain to work with because they're family. But at the same time, I wouldn't have it any other way. And there are pros and cons to everything, of course. But we get along very well, and we'll put in as much time as needed to execute on all sorts of things. And there's no better person you can depend on than your family member, at least for us. But at the end of the day, there's a lot of work to be done. And even though there are multiple Cousteaus out there in this generation, we three work very well together. And we work independently as well. We each have our own projects and passions. My sister, for example, is all about indigenous cultures, especially in the Amazon. When needs be, we can call on each other whenever we want. And today's world, everyone needs to be a little bit Cousteau, because we're facing some fundamental challenges that affect each and every one of us on this planet. So the more we as a family can help positively influence other communities out there, other individuals out there, the more I feel a sense that we're accomplishing our mission in life.
That's great. And, you know, I look further in your history. In 2009, you began your working with local communities and children worldwide to help restore local water ecosystems. This evolved in 2016 as the Fabian Cousteau Ocean Learning Center, a not-profit 501c3 foundation dedicated to the restoration of the world's water bodies through active community engagement and education. So indeed, your body of work demonstrates your commitment to the preservation of our oceans and future generations. So thank you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Well, I go back to saying, it's not enough to talk the talk. You have to walk the walk. And going on expeditions is very hard work, but it's a lot of fun. I couldn't ever imagine retiring. But at the same time, talking about the problems, or even the thrills of discoveries, is, in my opinion, not enough. One has to lead by example. And if there's something wrong, if you see something that that troubles you, and in my case, with the environment and the ocean, there are a lot of issues that are out there that need to be brought to light, but that in itself is not the solution. Trying to do your part, I do my part, is essential for us to get out of the predicament we've painted ourselves into. And so the Ocean Learning Center is, in a sense, a part of my give back to that solution building leadership. And the volunteers that come into our programs, the managers that manage the programs, I can't thank them enough. I try and participate as much as I can as well. And that's really the part of the give back of the master plan, I guess, until my light extinguishes at some point, hopefully many years from now.
Sure. Well, I mean, setting the example is being that leader, and then walking the walk is also important. You exemplify that in every direction. So thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
So let's take a step back in time to 2014. Mission 31.
Yep.
So what was Mission 31? Where was it located? Training, cost, funding. Let's go into a little bit of detail, because the next part of this will be to understand your medical, physical fitness preparation for these expeditions.
Sure. Mission 31 was very difficult. At that point, it was the most difficult project that I'd undertaken. Not just physiologically and emotionally, which of course were taxing, especially under the circumstances with Aquarius and all that, but also for the execution of it, starting with the fact that the managers of Aquarius were saying that it was impossible, that NASA had done 17 days, and that was already a real difficult thing to do. And anyone who knows me knows that I don't believe in the impossible. It just makes me want to do things even more. So, looking at how can we execute on 31 days at the bottom of the sea for two reasons: to see if people still cared about the ocean, and how much can we learn about it under the platform that was offered to us. And the difficulty was just getting to that point. Getting to day one of the mission. We had a lot of setbacks. We had a lot of challenges. Challenges because people didn't understand what we were doing. What? You want to live underwater for 31 days? Why? And where? And how? And all those things. So getting sponsorships and things like that was difficult. And thankfully, we had some wonderful sponsors to help us with that part. And then the legislation and the management of Aquarius was still under the NOAA regulations, which are very strict. And so there are certain elements of Mission 31 that we weren't able to execute on, such as DPVs and rebreathers and all those sorts of things, even though our team was very well seasoned in that world. But luckily, we had a lot of support and a lot of people who believed in it. And that included, of course, MIT, FIU, Northeastern University, and the students and professors of those education facilities, as well as the people at Aquarius Reef Base, who modified some of Aquarius so that we could do live Skype in the classroom sessions. Back then, Skype was a big thing,
sure.
And so on and so forth. So it was great. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, we did a lot with very little.
Sure. And tell me about the living conditions, the quarters, you know, the actual Aquarius Reef Base.
Well, anyone who lives in New York City might be familiar with the scenario. You know, you live in a studio apartment with five of your best friends.
Right.
That's basically, in a sense, what it was. I mean, Aquarius is about the size of a school bus. And within that, you have six people that execute a mission. And that means carrying with you a lot of your equipment, some of your supplies. And you know, they're nice tight quarters. You have a sleeping quarters area, which is basically a glorified way to say bunk room, where you have three bunks on either side. So you're all in a nice tight, cozy space about 6, 7, 8 feet wide. with a 2 foot wide corridor. And so whenever you're getting in and out of your bunk, you know, you usually bump into someone or wake someone up. And that's not really the point, because we didn't spend very much time sleeping. Mission 31 was very unique. I knew that we had to capitalize on maximizing the opportunities. And we end up spending 10 plus hours a day diving, each and every one of us, which had its own set of parameters and repercussions. You know, the galley was not very well equipped, you know, trying to squeeze six people to have dinner into a two-person table is not necessarily all that easy. And at the end of the day, though, I know this is not scientific or medical, but I almost felt like the slight sense of nitrogen narcosis probably made us get along a lot better.
Sure.
I think NASA may have done some studies on that. I'm not sure. But it was an interesting, really interesting, and on some level, very alien, and another level, very familiar, because we use common language to describe the sections of Aquarius. You've been there.
Sure.
It's like a camper van, in a sense, underwater. And luckily for us, we had a lot of surface support. So that one of the reasons why we could execute on 31 days is they did so much for us to be able to accomplish our mission.
Sure. And I think when you look at commercial divers that are living in a saturation mode for 30, 40 or more days, their biggest concern and medical concern is isolation.
Yeah.
And you were well prepared because you had VIP divers coming daily. You had the ability to communicate effectively with multiple modalities, and you had a team to support you.
Yeah, I mean, and that was very important. I have to say that, and we did. I did a verbal evaluation of how people felt at the end of the 31 days down there, the Aquanauts, and everyone had a different answer, and that's really plays a lot into your psychological makeup and what you're expecting and what you missed and everything else. I had a very different perspective, for example, than some of the others. As a matter of fact. And I don't know if you were there for this, but we had to switch someone out halfway through because they were showing signs of potentially becoming an issue for themselves and for the crew. That person got retired after 14 days. But for the rest of them, the answer of, would you go on, would you do more days, varied quite a bit. Under the circumstances of Aquarius, from I'm ready to go to the surface and see my family to I do another couple of weeks. Myself, I very rarely feel a sense of depression, but I must say that the last day I felt like I could do another month underwater. And the idea of giving up that access to the bottom world that was offered to us 24/7 for 31
sure.
days was a depressing thought to return back to an empty surface. You know, you pierce that blue veneer back into the surface and it goes from a fireworks display of life to emptiness with a boat ready to pick you up and bring you back to shore. So the psychological evaluation will be an integral part of Proteus because it's a very important tool to learn more about ourselves and our parameters and how to address isolated environments in an extreme or alien world. Not being able to go to the surface, even though it's only 60 feet above you, is something that plays quite heavily in your decision-making, in your everyday
sure.
decision-making. And of course, your physiological aspects of things, you also have to be very careful of this. They both interplay with each other, but psychologically, because you're underwater, because every action has amplified effect, because you're slightly narked, so you have to be very careful, because any mistake could be extremely detrimental. You had to be much, much more careful than you are in day-to-day lives on land.
Sure. And your immediate support team, so on board, You had yourself as a team leader, expedition leader. You also had two life support technicians, mm-hmm. and then you had three scientists that were part of the crew. Is that correct?
Correct, yeah. So the makeup of the team that was saturating were the two technicians that ran the habitat, that managed the dive operations, or at the very least, you know, monitored the dive operations. Then the scientists, of course, that executed on the various aspects of study, whether it be hydrocarbon pollution or predator-prey behavior, or any one of the dozen other things that we were looking at. And then you have, and of course, the expedition leader that was participating in a number of those things. And between the chief technician and myself, we'd be communicating back with Mission Control, where Roger would be the director of Mission Control. And we would make daily decisions on what we can and can't do, depending on weather, depending. One of the things, not to go too far back to your questions, but that I forgot to mention, is as opposed to being happy and seeing the surface teams and the VIPs coming down and everything else from the surface, the longer we stayed down, the more we became possessive of our neighborhood, which was very weird. I'd never felt these emotions before, but we all kind of felt the same way. We almost felt like the surface teams, as you know, week two and three, and then finally week four came around, were almost invaders into our space. Like, how dare they come down?
Right.
And you know, we're doing important work here. They're just coming down. They're interrupting our operations, and you know, now we've got to cater to them, and they're spooking our friends out there in the neighborhood. It was really interesting to see how we became more and more dependent on ourselves and more isolationists in a sense. And I'm hoping that with Proteus, we can dive deeper into that. But the surface team was essential because, you know, day three, the chiller broke. Without the surface team, we would have had to abort the mission.
Sure.
They came down and fixed and replaced the chiller. You know, our foodstuffs, our towels, because of course it's a very wet environment, you need dry towels, and so on and so forth. Without them, we couldn't have done any of this. And most of the science would have been not executable either, because
sure.
we needed that surface team to come down with all the various technologies and equipment that we just couldn't put in Aquarius.
So similar to the Calypso, where the Calypso wouldn't run unless the person who's scrubbing the rust off the bottom and the person who's making the meals, right? If it doesn't work as a good team, it's not going to be an effective expedition.
Oh, 100%, 100%. I mean, the six people down below was not the team.
Right.
They were the Aquanauts. They were saturated people, but you had two dozen people up above, including some Navy divers that were making sure that we were safe, that we had what we needed, that life support didn't break down, the LSB, the life support buoy, that was supplied with fuel and everything else. And without them, we wouldn't be able to stay down.
Right. And it seemed like the coordinator of all that dive safety was the mission team leader, Roger Garcia, who I think over the many years has done an exceptional job of keeping those people at the Aquanauts safe.
No doubt at all. I mean, Roger was has been for the life of Aquarius the director that makes sure that it's a well-oiled machine. Ex-Navy, saturation diver, all those things. He has a lot of stripes on his arm.
Sure.
But without a director. Mission Control director like Roger and his support team, none of these missions would ever happen.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about your preparation before Mission 31. How did you prepare yourself physically, mentally, prior to the actual mission?
Well, that's really important. That's probably the most important aspect to being able to withstand the stressors and rigors of daily life underwater as an Aquanaut. So prior to Mission 31, we were encouraged, and I encouraged my team to do exercise. Even for those who did exercise, that was great. They just added to their routine. For others like myself, who are more into outdoor activities, climbing, swimming, etc., I made sure that the exercise routine was more regimented. And, you know, an hour a day of swimming, that sort of thing. making sure that I was eating healthy things, and being prepared for what was ended up being very strenuous activity. We ended up in Aquarius eating a lot of junk food, and by that I mean that because of the parameters of saturation, you can't cook with open flame and so on and so forth. Therefore, it gives you very limited ability to feed yourself, a little bit like in space. And so we relied on freeze-dried foods and things like that for the vast majority of our meals. And as most people know, those are prepackaged foods, camping food, all that stuff is really not good for you.
Right.
High sodium and so on and so forth. And so we had to make sure that we were in as good a shape as we could be before the mission, considering what we were going to end up torturing. As a French person, by the way, that's probably the worst part of the whole mission. The most difficult part was
sure.
The food was terrible. And we supplemented that, of course, with things like M&Ms.
Oh, I know. That would impress me when you and I were having a conversation in the galley. In front of us was a bowl of chocolate-covered M&Ms.
Yeah.
And I remember distinctly I hadn't had breakfast. I was now dehydrated from the humidity and the excitement of, you know, getting up at 4 a.m. to be there on time to come down to Aquarius Reef Base. And I'm staring at you, and then I'm staring at the M&Ms. And then I'm looking off to the side of the portal, and I see Barracuda coming by, mm-hmm. and I'm like thinking, I should have an M&M, but I kind of held off until after we had our conversation.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's one of the few things you still have pretty much a full taste of is peanut-covered M&Ms, unless, of course, you're allergic to peanuts, in which case you can't have them. It's one of the only foods, if you can even call it a food, snacks, that's high in calories, that you can taste, that doesn't taste awful, that gives you a boost of sugar and energy. And it became kind of the cliche at Aquarius
sure.
as far as snacks. Well, you know, you burn up to 3 times as many calories in a daily routine in saturation at Aquarius than you do on land. So despite all the junk food that we're eating, despite all the supplemental snacking that we did, I'm not a big guy, I still ended up losing 17 pounds.
Wow.
And during those 31 days. So it's the world's most expensive fat farm, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah. But also, I think in a saturated environment as well as in space, you also lose your taste, right, for
yes.
that period of time,
yeah.
which for whether you're French or not French, right, yeah. that's horrible. Now, people now can relate because of COVID, they
right.
have that sense of what that might be like. But during that period of time, it makes eating that much more less enjoyable.
Yeah.
And then the crunch of a M&M is something that brings back a good memory, a fine memory, and that sweet chocolate, it kind of lightens up your taste buds just for a few moments.
Absolutely. And that plays heavily, and obviously into your physical reaction to it, but also your psychological reaction, which is very important. So although it is junk food, it did have a kind of a feeling of home. And that's always a welcome thing. We also, thanks to the surface crew, occasionally got care packages. So we would get fresh food sometimes. You know, the problem with that kind of environment is things oxidize very quickly. So fresh foods don't last underwater.
Right.
You know, apples, lettuce, whatever comes down. But for that glimmer of a moment, people ravenously eat the fresh food.
Another thing that happens when you're in the saturation environment, the humidity goes
yes.
up, temperature
yes.
goes up.
Yep.
And
inevitably.
It takes you a period of time to acclimatize. How long did it take you to acclimatize to that environment?
Well, I would say probably first few days. One of the things that was as a new aquanaut was an interesting factor. Now, we had a test run before Mission 31's first day, where we went into Aquarius to familiarize ourselves with our environment. But going in there, knowing that you were going to be there for 31 days was a different story. And you know, getting into the moon pool and taking your wetsuit off and your dive gear off for the very first time, and all of a sudden realize this is going to be my home for 31 days. And all of a sudden you start paying attention to the finer details. The swell, even though it was three atmospheres down, the swell from the surface, you could still feel it in your ears because of the pressure variance. And you get used to that, but in the first few days, it's very distracting. The feeling of kind of a sense of well-being, almost like you had a glass of wine. You know, you go from this high, not energy, but almost not anxiety quite, but like, oh my God, I'm here. Excitement maybe, to a feeling of, okay, yeah, I can relax now, and so on and so forth. You have to be very careful of that. But that you start feeling a kind of a different mental attitude. Realizing that, you know, when you visited it, it seemed like a much bigger place now. And now that you have all your equipment in there and people and personnel coming to visit and everything else, it becomes a very tight place.
Sure.
So all these things start playing into the first few days of adaptation. And you can only bring down with you what can fit into one potted container. So I would bring down a couple of books, brought down a couple of tchotchkes, my phone, they brought down my computer because I had to work. But other than that, that was it. You had clothes on your back. Sure. And that was it.
And I remember I came down to you on day 22 as a VIP diver. Mm-hmm. And I got into the Aquarius habitat. They had me shower to get all the debris and
the salt
off from, you know, the environment. Mm-hmm. And when I came inside, you were wearing a hoodie.
Yes.
Right? And I was drenched in sweat. And they were actually toweling off everywhere I walk because I was so perspiring so much that it was increasing the moisture content within the Aquarius habitat. And you were like, you know, wearing a hoodie, kind of like shivering a little bit.
Yeah,
and I'm thinking, boy, this guy really has acclimatized to this condition, and I have not.
Right. Well, yeah. So there's definitely a bit of a change that happens when you stay down for a certain length of time. For example, your blood pressure tends to go down, your heart rate tends to go down, and those things play a lot into how you stay warm. And of course, as you mentioned, it's a humid environment. And although it's kept at around 72 degrees inside, it feels cold because of the humidity, because of all the exhaustion. And so for us, we were always bundled up. We were always in hoodies. Sometimes, most often in shorts, just because it's easier to get in and out of your dive gear. But sometimes at night, if you're not doing a night dive, we'd be in our sweatpants. And this is in, you know, it's mid 70s degrees, but you're not in the sun. You're in a humid environment. So things get cold fairly quickly. The inverse is also true. As I mentioned, our chiller went out. And a chiller is basically the underwater equivalent of an air conditioner to try and keep that humidity at bay as much as possible and to keep the temperature at bay, because having six bodies in a small space, along with all the electronics and everything else, that space warms up. When that chiller went out, it went from 72, 73 degrees within a few hours. We were at 98 degrees and 100% humidity, and it was quite literally raining inside, and it was a miserable experience. And it almost caused us to abort the mission. And had we not had that chiller fixed, we would have had to do so. As a matter of fact, two of the researchers that were down with us were sleeping on the aluminum deck, as uncomfortable as that was, just to try and stay cool. And we regularly take dips in 82 degree water, you know, Florida water, just to cool down.
Wow, it's pretty impressive. So let's fast forward to 2022, 8 years later. How do you address your physical fitness and nutrition as you're getting older as an expedition leader and diver?
Yeah, I'm ashamed to say I don't do as much as I should just because of daily activities, but I still try and stay active. I mean, I'm obviously that much older now, which it's even more important because it's a lot harder to lose weight. It's a lot harder to gain muscle mass and to just be physically fit in general. So I still swim a lot. I still go through, other than the hard hat diving, those trials, that training, basically I do laps underwater on one breath of air to make sure that I can still pass all those tests for the next mission. And just trying generally to stay active, biking, more cardio than anything else. I've never been a big weightlifter or anything, but trying to keep myself as physically fit as possible, knowing that around the corner may be my next mission, is important. And it's generally a good idea because I'd like to grow old and healthy rather sure. than unhealthy.
Well, the alternative isn't all that great. So that's,
I'd rather not grow old. I'd rather stay the same old kid yeah. that I am, but
so we learn from our mistakes and mistakes of others and hopefully never repeat those mistakes or misadventures. Can you share any stories of a fellow dive team member that might have had an issue with his fitness or her fitness that might have been classified as a misadventure?
You know, over the decades and the generations, we've been privileged to have people around us that were pioneers, that were people who believed in the mission, people who believed in the adventure. Most of them were somewhat fit, but in the early days, of course, of drinking wine and smoking cigarettes, people didn't know better. And you know, you could still see in today's world a lot of divers that smoke, which I don't get, but hey, you know, to each their own, as unhealthy as that may be. I've seen and heard of unfortunate accidents due to being inadvertent, being too or not paying attention, due to physical limitations, due to being unfit, due to pushing the limits way too far. We've even been witness to in our team in the early days, not my team, but in the early days of people who didn't make it back because they decided to go way beyond the limits. They decided not to listen to their peers. So, you know, tragedy happens when you don't follow the basic rules. And sometimes even when you do in an extreme environment, when you're in unknown territory. You know, even if you're physically fit, you have to be aware that psychologically, emotionally, you change underwater. And the deeper you go, the more you can make mistakes, not knowing or being in an altered state because of narcosis and other things. So you have to be very careful of that. And, you know, sometimes it's just pure sad accident. Things like getting a caustic cocktail from just a failure of technology in a rebreather to much worse. You just never wake up. So those are the extremes.
Sure.
But most of the things that happen underwater are thankfully minor, you know, boo-boos, scrapes, contusions, minor accidents. You have to be very careful in saturation because you don't have access to the topside world. You have to treat things in saturation. So if you have an ear infection, which happened on Mission 31, those go rampant very quickly. So you have to treat them and you have to stay out of the water for a few days. Skin infections, same thing. I guess flip side of the coin, what was surprising to me is how quickly my hair grew underwater. You know, so it
maybe
was very
I should
strange.
Return then.
I mean, this is anecdotal observation. Obviously, we'd have to study this a little bit deeper, right. further. But it seems that you know, hyperbaric environments do have some benefits.
In addition,
you would know that better than me.
In humidity, yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
So this has really been informative, and I think that the lessons learned from Mission 31 are really preparing you well for the upcoming Proteus mission as it becomes more actualized. Fabien Cousteau, it was a pleasure to have you on this episode of Fitness and Diving. I want to thank you for taking the time to share your experience and insight. This conversation will have significant impact to our listeners.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure being here, and hopefully your listeners have learned a little something, or at least we've sparked their curiosity.
Absolutely. This is Dr. David Cherish, dive medicine physician from Dive Medicine and Hyperbaric Consultants, with another episode of Fitness and Diving. The Fitness and Diving podcast is available wherever you get your podcasts.